This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McClinton. And I was thinking, Wade, now that we're past the 250 episode milestone, Maybe a little bit of a rebranding is in order. I suggest the new name for the podcast be, wait for it, Podcast Team.
Wow, Kevin, that's incredible. And who says we have to keep this on planet Earth? We could send out our podcast to the moon.
How hard could it be, really?
What's the worst that could happen? Today in the episode, we're reviewing the new Netflix comedy from Steve Carell and Greg Daniels, Space Force.
We also have a new biopic on the docket for you, Josephine Decker's new film about the author Shirley Jackson, titled Shirley, is coming up in the second half of the episode.
And we surely are going to have a fun time on episode 251 of Seeing and Believing.
I want to welcome our newest four-star general, Mark Naird, formerly number two at the Air Force.
Thank you. It has always been my dream to command a service branch.
Our nation's internet runs through our vulnerable space satellites. POTUS wants complete space dominance. To that end, the president is creating a new branch, Space Force, which Mark will run.
What? Listeners, this is episode 251 of Seeing and Believing. Kevin, we are always trying to offer our listeners a creative intro. I think the introduction today was pretty creative. And I do have to say, when we did our Michael Caine impressions a couple of episodes back for our review for A Trip to Greece, my wife Priscilla heard it and she said it was funny. So that's a win in my book.
I am overjoyed to hear that. I was a little bit scared to inflict our terrible Michael Caine impressions on my wife. So it's good to know that Priscilla got some enjoyment out of it. Maybe I should break it out and play it for Kylie after all, but maybe not.
You know, Priscilla doesn't listen to every episode, but she'll listen to episodes. She'll ask my opinion about films. And if she disagrees with me about a movie, she's always like, I need to come on the podcast and set this straight. And I said, why don't we just have an all wives podcast episode? And it's just you and Kylie, and you talk about how wrong we are. I think it would be great listening. I think it'd be awesome.
I would listen to that. I'd be happy for the time off, and I'd love to, you know, have two guests on the show instead of just one guest, just sort of duking it out in their own way. That'd be cool.
Yes. Now, when I say how we're wrong, I don't mean in general, just about films. We have to keep that because the episode has to be within the time frame. It can't go over too long.
That seems like a good guardrail to have in place.
Well, speaking of hapless characters, this week's episode begins with a glance at the new Netflix comedy, Space Force. I love saying Space Force, Kevin. Created by Steve Carell and Greg Daniels, Space Force introduces viewers to the trials and the tribulations of a four-star general played by Carell, whose sole mission is to get boots on the moon by 2024. Over the course of its 10-episode first season, General Naird teams up with his opposite, Dr. Adrian Mallory, played by John Malkovich, to thwart Chinese and Russian interference, as well as meet the expectations set by a president who enacts policy via Twitter. Ben Schwartz, Diana Silvers, Tawny Newsom, and Jimmy O. Yang also co-star. Kevin, in the past, we've talked a little bit about some of Daniels' previous television programs, most notably The Office, and I think we've even mentioned Parks and Rec. Now, inevitably, Space Force, an unusual workplace comedy, we'll draw comparisons to those two properties. To get our discussion started, I want to ask you this. In your opinion, how does Space Force stack up against television shows like The Office and Parks and Rec? Is it a new classic, or is it a mostly forgettable fare?
Well, you can definitely tell that Space Force sprang from some of the same minds that The Office and Parks and Rec did, because it does kind of share a similar perspective on its characters, which is that they're basically, they're flawed, but they're basically lovable, and you can tell that the writers really want the best for General Naird and the people around him. They want him to succeed in their endeavor to make Space Force the best Space Force that it can be. And I think part of my problem with Space Force is similar to my problem with The Office and Parks and Recreation, is that Greg Daniels just, there's something about the way that he does comedy, which is that he really just, he can't help but love the characters he creates, which is nice in a show, for instance, like Parks and Recreation, where it's basically kind of an up with people, optimistic look at humanity and state government. With Space Force and the U.S. Office, particularly the latter seasons of the U.S. Office, I think it begins to drag the show down as there are these characters who kind of over time become a little bit more more cuddly than they really should be given what we know about them. With Space Force, I feel like the show starts off really strong, but over time it begins to get a little bit wearisome how Greg Daniels kind of wants to pull all of his punches when it comes to General Naird himself. There's just enough of an impulse to make the audience love General Naird rather than just enjoy watching a show about General Naird that I think eventually, for me, drags the show down and makes it somewhat less than the sum of its parts.
Well, you say the show started strong. I don't think it started, it was never strong at all. I am not a fan of Space Force. And I'm sure we'll talk about character development. I'm sure we'll talk about plot. I think for me, the biggest offense is that Space Force isn't very funny. It's a comedy, but I didn't find myself laughing all that much. Humor can cover a multitude of sins. And you mentioned some of the weaknesses of The Office and some of the weaknesses of Parks and Rec. And there are weaknesses in those television shows. But most of the time, those television shows are very funny. This one isn't. And so I found myself just sort of, I don't know, wondering why I was watching this television show. And obviously, I'm watching the first season because we are reviewing the first season. But what keeps me going if I don't have to finish this? And I'm not really sure if there's anything that keeps me going, because this is just, I think it's just a mess, Kevin. I really do.
Well, let's drill down a little bit into why it's not funny, because I do agree that after about the second episode, I began to start checking my watch during episodes, kind of wondering, okay, well, when are we going to get to the big payoff or the huge belly laugh or the really sharp writing that will kind of enliven what I'm seeing on screen a little bit? And the reason I say that the first episode worked for me is, or the reason I said that the show starts strong, I should say, is that the first episode I thought really did make me laugh. I liked the sketch of the characters that we got in that first episode. Just Fred Willard's appearance, which was, you know, given his recent passing, was just, it was good for my heart to see him there. I mean, he said one line and it just made me burst out laughing. And I think that there's enough there that I was looking forward to the episodes to come because I thought, okay, well, all the ingredients are here for a very funny series. I want to see where this goes. I think the problem for me is that it never really goes anywhere interesting. The sketches of the characters that we get in that pilot don't really get developed over the course of this year, of this first season. We don't really get a whole lot in their relationships that we don't see in that first episode. And in fact, over time, the characters begin to get a little bit more friendly with each other than they were in the first episode. There was kind of this adversarial relationship that Naird had with the scientist, Dr. Mallory, played by a great John Malkovich. There's some nice adversarial stuff going on between some of the other characters as well. I was even looking forward to seeing maybe if the very outlines of political satire that we get with the Congress people that are in the first episode, I was looking forward to seeing if maybe that would get sketched out. I think the problem is Greg Daniels and Steve Carell and their writers don't ever really follow through on that promise. And in fact, those adversarial, spikier elements of the writing kind of get toned down into something that becomes a lot more palatable. We get a lot of scenes that really kind of want you to emotionally invest in these characters. And I think that's all wrong for this material. It kind of wants to be more like an Armando Iannucci satire. And it ends up feeling like Armando Iannucci with all of his teeth pulled. There's no bite there.
I thought of the death of Stalin when I watched this. And then I also thought of Dr. Strangelove from Stanley Kubrick. And this television show comes nowhere close to either of those properties, but we get sharp political satire in those films, and I think this television show wants to do that. And we are in a difficult place for satire. There are direct references in this television show to the Trump administration. And it's not even that the show is exaggerating certain elements. It's just pulling from headlines. And as a result, it just doesn't seem all that funny. It feels like low-hanging fruit. And I think I've said this before about other films or television shows that are, quote-unquote, about this administration. And I was thinking about a tweet, and I believe the tweet was from Matt Zollersides. I believe it was from him. And he mentioned the films that will be made about COVID-19 and the pandemic. And then he said something that surprised me, but I think it's true. He says, out of all of those, Spielberg will probably make something that's not about the pandemic, and yet it will speak to the pandemic more than anything else. And I was thinking of Death of Stalin. I was even thinking, as I mentioned, Dr. Strangelove, and these properties that are certainly about social issues, but they're taking this roundabout approach. Now, Space Force goes at it directly. I just don't know if there's enough here to really make that bite. And you mentioned taking teeth out, and that's certainly what it feels like. And then you were talking about Steve Carell's character. At first, I didn't know if he was supposed to be this lovable buffoon, this shrewd thinker. I didn't know if they were going to turn him dark. And in the end, I think they really lean towards lovable buffoon. But there's not enough there to even actually make me care. I'd rather him be terrible. I'd rather him be just infuriating than to be what he is now, because it just feels very bland. And I don't really care about him. And I don't know why we're supposed to care so much about the relationships around him, because as you mentioned, they're not developed. And I think the one that stands out the most to me is the relationship with the general and his daughter, who's played by Diana Silvers. They allude to problems in episode one, and we just don't get any depth. The most is, oh, he doesn't spend enough time with her. That's really it. And there could have been some really great material mined there, and it just wasn't explored.
There's very little specificity in the relationships, you're right. And I think that extends also to the its satirical vision as well, if you could even say that it has a satirical vision. The reason that an Iannucci film or series, such as, you know, like Veep, for instance, is a show that's all about politics, and where Veep succeeds and Space Force doesn't, is that Veep seems to have a very strong vision of what people in politics are like, rather than just sort of like pulling from the headlines, oh, there's this ridiculous thing this one congressperson did. It kind of synthesizes that headline into an overall worldview of what the human animal is like when it's in the world of politics. Similarly, Strangelove has a very particular view of what human nature is like when it's just armed with these enormously destructive weapons and has the power and the will to use them. Like what does that vision of human nature look like in general? And having that worldview, Kubrick can then go in and make it specific and sharp and very, very funny, because he knows exactly kind of what he's trying to say, what his satirical targets are, and how that fits into an overall perspective. I think the problem with Space Force is its perspective can really be summed up as, isn't Space Force kind of wacky? Aren't buttoned down generals a little bit silly? Aren't, you know, presidents who don't care about science ridiculous? Like, it's all kind of very nebulous. And yes, all of those things are true. Like, those things are kind of silly and wacky and ridiculous, but there's not really, like, there needs to be something underneath that. Like, anybody can make a comedy about people, silly people acting silly. I think the challenge is to make a comedy about silly people acting silly that actually has some sort of perspective on, well, what does that mean? You know, like, why are we watching this instead of just watching people throwing pies in each other's faces? And I don't think that Space Force really has that. It's kind of just a collection of quirks and some characters who are thrown into a relationship in various configurations, but there's no real glue holding it together in terms of a perspective on, well, who are these characters really? How do they fit into the world around them? And what does that kind of speak to our current moment? There's not really any of that, which may not be a problem for a show that's not really going for contemporary commentary, but Space Force is very much trying for that. And the fact that it fails so spectacularly is definitely a problem.
It is. It is trying for that. I will say there is one episode, episode 5. It's directed by Dee Reese, and she directed the 2017 film Mudbound that we really liked. We weren't big fans of her 2020 film, The Last Thing He Wanted, that premiered on Netflix. But she directed, I believe, two episodes, and one of them was, it really revolved around this War Games sequence between Space Force and between the Air Force. And there are some silly, strange sort of elements to this episode. But I liked how the episode highlighted this stretch for violence, even when attempting to go to the moon. And so these two forces, they are going to be shooting at each other with BBs in an attempt to pop balloons. And that represents them popping an astronaut suit. And so the idea is, okay, if you are on the moon and you're fighting with Russia or China, then you've got to learn how to survive. And then they're also testing out these other contraptions that will help them. And throughout this episode, they highlight just the macho-ness of these characters. And there are a couple of scenes, some of the set designs, that reminded me a little bit of Dr. Strangelove, that they emphasized these sort of ideas about warfare and our proclivity to violence. And then in the episode, there's this science competition, and nobody seems to care, even though it's very, very important. Instead, they all care about this BB gun battle. I also think it's probably the funniest episode. And I would have liked to see a little bit more of that in the television show. There's a lot of it, and it feels very on the nose, but it didn't dig into anything that, I don't know if you'd say revelatory, but it didn't shine any new lights on this material. And so as a result, I felt disengaged from the characters, from the plot, and also from what this television show is saying exactly. Is it saying that going to the moon is just us spending a ton of money that we don't have? Or is it trying to figure out the balance between what drives us to go to a place like this? Could it be a negative drive? Or in addition, could there be some positive aspects? And the television show just doesn't really do that. I will agree with you, Kevin, that John Malkovich is very good. He's one of the best aspects of this television show, and I would have loved to see him just duke it out with Steve Carell a little bit more, but they kind of make amends at the end of the first episode, it feels like. I mean, they argue a little bit, but it's not, it doesn't feel like a rivalry, and that's kind of sad because it takes away some of the conflict.
I think that kind of highlights part of like my overall problem with Space Force, which is that, you know, it does seem to often kind of purport to offer some sort of satirical viewpoint on, just to name one example, the conflict between science and the military or macho-ness. Like there's often this perspective that science in this reality doesn't really matter, which, you know, is not exactly something that's going to blow anybody's mind who's living in our reality. That's definitely something that's occurring here as well. But the problem is that the central character who kind of represents the scientific rational viewpoint and the one who acts as sort of the person putting the brakes on Nerd's jingoistic, you know, rah-rah America outlook is Dr. Mallory, but Greg Daniels can't really resist having them be buddies at the end. And I think that kind of sinks the whole enterprise if he's really trying to create something that effectively satirizes certain elements of our own reality. Is just, if everybody ends up being buddy-buddy at the end, that doesn't really feel like an accurate reflection of the way things actually are, and it doesn't really seem to feel true to who these characters are as well. Why Nerd and Mallory can make up at the end rather than constantly being at loggerheads over the use of Mallory's science for Nerd's war making, there's never really any attempt to harmonize those. It's just sort of, they kind of hug and make up at the end of every episode and we move on to the next episode. It's kind of this weird, it's sitcom logic applied to a movie that otherwise is trying to position itself much more as a political satire or something that's trying to do more than just being an entertaining 30 minutes of sitcom comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when it's not all that entertaining, that becomes even bigger of a problem.
Yes.
I will say, too, and I'm trying to put my finger on it, trying to explain it, there's this level of absurdity to the television show. So there's one scene, it's real quick, where Steve Carell accidentally pushes a button in the control room and it launches a rocket into space and I think it blows up. So it's absurd, right? That would never happen in real life. And I feel like the television show can't find that balance, the balance between absurdity and believability. And it's as if they kind of go back and forth and they make rules and they break rules. And it's just so distant from this world that we live in some respects. I mentioned that some political aspects feel like they're pulled from the headlines. It was hard for me to believe or to buy into what was happening. And I don't know exactly how to express that, but it has to do with the tone, the absurdity, the believability, and how this television show mixes it all together. And it just, for me, it isn't all that coherent.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a good way to just sum it up as a whole, is that it's just, there's a lot of different ingredients that maybe could theoretically work, but tossed together in the way they are in this series, they simply don't. Listeners, that is our review of Netflix's new television show, Space Force. If you have had a chance to watch all or some of the episodes since they released, we'd love to know your thoughts. You can email us those at seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. We'd also love to hear from you on Twitter at cbelievepod. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be kicking off our second segment with a review of Josephine Decker's Shirley.
The song is Vegetarian by David Cricket. You know, listeners, we very much appreciate all of you who've taken the time to support us. One way that you can support us is by hopping on our Patreon page and becoming a monthly donor. We have a number of different donation levels, and one of our favorites is the What Can You Buy for $5 level. Kevin, what could someone buy for $5?
$5 would get you some stilts so that you don't have to wear a mask while you go outside. You can just be above the fray, literally, because you're 3 feet taller than everyone else. So there's no chance of droplets either reaching you or getting from you to them. I don't know if that's actually how infectious diseases work, but I don't know. It's only $5. So how much prevention do you expect to get out of $5 stilts?
Yeah, well, I said it earlier. What's the worst that could happen? I will say it might protect you, but the droplets could hypothetically fall on someone else. We are not medical advisors, so whatever you do, listeners, it's at your own risk. $5 will get you that, or you can support us. Just hop on over to Patreon, patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You are putting on clean clothes and sitting at the table for a proper meal.
I can't.
You will. Besides, it's cocktail hour.
It's going to be so dull.
Well, I didn't ask you to behave at the table.
We're back with the second half of our show. I was trying to think of a nice spooky way to put that, you know, something like, you know, the beginning of The Haunting of Hill House, like whatever walked there walked alone, you know, something creepy. But I don't know that segment intros in a podcast really lend themselves to that kind of mystique.
No, I don't know. I mean, we could put a synthesizer on you and maybe some mood music that could help. But I don't know. I'd be pretty frightened if that happened.
Yeah, I think that it's probably best not to monkey with things over much. I mean, if we do have a synthesizer, or maybe some theremin music, like a nice theremin intro to the second segment might do the trick. But there for now, I guess we'll just have to leave it be and turn to our discussion of the movie that looks at the life of the person who wrote The Haunting of Hill House, Shirley Jackson. Shirley is director Josephine Decker's follow-up to 2018's Madeline's Madeline, another film that dealt with the blurred line between story and reality. In this film, Elizabeth Moss plays Shirley Jackson, the famous writer of works like The Haunting of Hill House and the short story read in high school English classes everywhere, The Lottery. We first meet Jackson as a mercurial shut-in, living in a huge house with her English professor husband, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, as a young couple moves in with them temporarily while they search for more temporary housing. That's a setup straight out of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Edward Albee's play that was later made into a movie about the curdled relationships among a bunch of academics, and at first that seems to be the direction that Shirley is going in. But before long, Decker takes us out of that realm and into a realm that's more elliptical and deals much more with Jackson's creative process and how her relationships play into the writing of her latest novel. So, Wade, this is a film that is a biopic, and you and I have been a little bit down on biopics in the past, just in terms of how they adhere a little bit too much to formula when they present real life figures to us. My question for you is, given that Shirley doesn't adhere quite as much to that formula, did that help at all in your viewing of this film? Or do you find that this is another film that must be relegated, sadly, to the biopics aren't that great pile?
Well, this reminds me of a biopic that we disagreed on that I liked when you were talking about this, and that was the Danny Boyle Steve Jobs biopic that I felt like was unconventional and worked really well. You didn't like it. So this film, Shirley, very different from Steve Jobs, but it is unconventional. And I do have to applaud Decker because she approaches this story from a completely different angle. And if I understand correctly, this is actually based on a novel that is based on Shirley Jackson. So very much from the beginning, we get the sense that this is not a life story that's going to give us the ins and outs of Jackson's history, but hopefully let us in on the ethos of her work. And in that sense, I think the movie does succeed. Now, my response to it is probably not a great gauge of that film's success because I didn't really enjoy the movie all that much. There's only so much I can take of really mean artists who are jerks who at the end of the story create something great. It didn't work for me on that level. I think gender roles are explored better here than some of other biopics that I've seen, but I don't know if there was enough to really hook me. But that's also a personal preference and just the way I reacted to the movie, and I'm sure that other people really just kind of gobble this up, especially if they had that personal connection to Jackson's work.
So mean artists who are jerks is not the quick ticket into Wade's good graces, though. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Now, I guess Steve Jobs was a jerk in the film, so maybe I do break the rules sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, if you pay attention to that film, it would argue that Jobs is an artist of sorts. So I don't know. Maybe there are exceptions to every rule. I guess we'll have to see when the next mean artist who is a jerk movie comes out.
There you go.
Later on. I think that this film was tremendously engaging, and it sounds like I enjoyed it a little bit more than you did. I think what I appreciate about Decker's approach is how, I don't know, I guess backing up, the one thing that we complained about with movies like, say, Bohemian Rhapsody or, there was another
Rocket Man, maybe?
It might have been Rocket Man. Essentially, these movies that kind of try to let us into the creative process somehow. Like they show an artist creating something that will go yeah. on to be known as, you know, a seminal piece of work or their most famous album or something like that. And something that you and I have complained about before on the show, is how these sequences never really do a good job of making, of letting us as the audience in on what it feels like to create. Like, what does the creative impulse feel like for this person that we're watching on screen? Like, what is the experience of creating like? We all know what the end result is, but what's it like to be kind of in the thick of making something, or in the thick of imagining something or conceptualizing a work that has never existed before in the history of mankind? That's kind of what these artists are supposed to do. And in this film, I think that it does actually a very good job of bringing us into that headspace a little bit more. And I think Decker does that by kind of taking a much more elliptical approach, where we're kind of moving around. She relies a lot on shallow focus, where we see what's in the foreground and what's in the background is kind of blurry, kind of fuzzy, but there's still stuff moving around back there that we can kind of just barely glimpse and try to make out, you know, who it is or what's going on back there. And I think these stylistic choices end up coming together in a way that isn't really, you can't really articulate why, or at least I can't really articulate why, for me, it does really bring me into what this version of Shirley Jackson might have been feeling and experiencing as she's in the thick of writing this novel and using the people around her as inspiration. Odessa Young plays the young wife of this professor who's the assistant to Shirley Jackson's husband, played by Michael Stuhlbarg. And this young wife kind of becomes the inspiration for Jackson to write this novel about a young woman who disappears and what might have been going through this woman's head as she walked down the path towards her disappearance. And I think Decker does a really good job of making us feel what that might be like. I think in the end, there are parts of it that I feel like maybe don't quite cohere into something great by the end, but I did appreciate all of the moving parts that Josephine Decker brings to the fore here. And I think it gives the film this very interesting texture that I think is so often missing from biopics and stories about artists in general.
Yeah, I appreciate that you pointed out the idea of creation. And I've talked about that scene in Bohemian Rhapsody where, you know, Freddie Mercury is at a table and he's like, gosh, yeah, that's it, yeah. And, you know, here the camera has a lot of POV shots, tight shots, handheld shots. We get the sense that we're watching characters. The camera is shooting across individuals. They're out of focus and we're watching a conversation from afar. And so the form of the movie sets itself up as this intimate look at the struggle, the fight to create something great and something meaningful. And we don't get Elizabeth Moss's Jackson, who's just erratic and everywhere, and then just decides, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write this. And there's a montage and we get the novel. She's constantly working on this story. She is thinking about lines. She's daydreaming. She is typing. She's getting angry. And by the end of the movie, you do feel like, oh, wow, writing, creating is not easy. It is hard. It is so hard to write a book. It's like, you know, people say, you know, writing a book is like giving birth to a baby and you care for it and then you give it away and you hope that it's grown up. And, you know, when I wrote my book, it was a little bit harder than that. It was like, you know, cutting this growth off your body and getting it out there and then saying, okay, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this. It's just a lot of work and it's a struggle. And I think the film does kind of capture that. I don't know how cohesive it is with, you mentioned the side character played by Odessa Young, and she is positioned as one of the main characters and she's the focus of the film for part of the time. She's our eyes She is our eyes inside of this world. And it's also about her trying to grow up and her trying to find out who she is as a person. She married young. She's having a child. And I don't know how all that flows together so well. And the end feels a bit untidy to me. So I think that's probably to the film's weakness, but it does nail a couple of things, and I've got to hand it to the movie when it hits those hard.
Well, I'd argue that all of these disparate plot strands and character arcs do end up coming together in painting kind of this picture of feminine genius, I guess, or feminine creativity, at least. We'll go that far. I feel like there's so many movies where we get the myth of masculine genius. You know, you get movies like Capote or Phantom Thread. Like Daniel Day-Lewis's character in Phantom Thread is this guy who's just so good at what he does, and the privilege that he claims from that is just treating the people around him however he wants to treat them. He just claims his genius as license to live as he pleases, and he doesn't want other people imposing on that. I think this film does something similar, but Decker lends it a different feel than something like Phantom Thread. You get the sense that in this film, Shirley Jackson's genius takes the form of being just ferociously unwilling to make space, to accommodate other people, to be agreeable, to fit the type of the dutiful wife or the well-mannered female artist. Like these are all attributes that under normal circumstances, and at least especially for the wife of a prominent academic as Jackson is, that these are all kind of roles that society would expect of a woman in her position, and her refusal to really play by those rules, to be intentionally rude to people, or to refuse to put on makeup or to do her hair when receiving company. All of these things are very much, it's another portrait of an artist kind of being standoffish, and that's part of their genius. But as framed by Decker here, it's got a different quality than the male genius that we're used to seeing. It's related, but it's not exactly the same. And I think it's interesting to watch that developed in the multiple different directions that it is developed over the course of this film.
I like the review that Sheila O'Malley put up on RogerEbert.com, and she has an overall very positive take on the film. And she notes a scene, I think it's more towards the end of the movie, where Jackson is at a party and she spills wine on a couch. And she decides to rub it. And the hostess says, no, you know, don't rub it, dab it. And it's a great illustration of being on the in and being on the out. Being the woman who does exactly what she's supposed to do. She dabs. And then you have Jackson, who is a unique and talented individual. And she goes about her life very differently. And I think that's a great scene to really touch on this film and to encapsulate this movie. I do think there's this heavy presence in the movie. And part of that is it just makes it not all enjoyable. This ominous, plucky music. There's this heaviness to this atmosphere of Jackson and her mental state, but also of Stuhlbarg's Stanley, who is not a terrible husband, but he's not a great husband. And then on top of that, the way this couple talks to each other. So Stuhlbarg, as he's talking to Moss, they're conversing. It's as if they're inside of a book. They say, dear, loved ones, simpletons. And it gives us this this intellectual pride and this intellectual air. They are looking down on everyone around them, while at the same time, the people around them are looking down at them, specifically Jackson. And it does offer this really unique picture of artistic genius and what goes into that. And to be truly original, which is a good thing in art, is not always a good thing in just our day-to-day lives.
Well, there's a reason that the two movies that just kind of occurred to me off the top of my head as I was watching this one were Capote and Phantom Thread. Capote, because in that film, we really explore what it's like when somebody's devotion to their art kind of supersedes all other concerns. And in this film, we also get the sense that Jackson wants to make something great, and the relationships around her, the stories that she hears, the individuals that she interacts with, it's not that she's utterly indifferent to them, but it's more that they're all material to her. They all kind of feed into her genius, and they come out in the form of her writing. And meanwhile, while she's doing that creation, the relationships kind of bend and shift in order to accommodate that use of the relationship, I guess. So the relationship between Jackson and Odessa Young's Rosie, this young wife, starts off being adversarial. It morphs into friendship. It eventually turns quasi-romantic, but it's almost like there's emotion involved, but there's also something else. There's something that they're both trying to get out of that liaison that they can't get with the relationships with the men in their lives. And they find it in each other, but it's not love. They both need to get something for themselves. And I think that that's a really interesting thread for Decker to pull on. And I think it feeds into the reason why Phantom Thread was the other film that I immediately thought of. Phantom Thread shows this relationship that first we kind of think, oh, one person is in control and the other person is sort of being dominated by him. And then as the film goes on, we begin to realize, no, these people are kind of, they're intertwined in this relationship where they're very, it's a very toxic relationship, but the toxicity isn't completely one way, or at least they need each other. And the toxicity is a part of that need. And we see that in the relationship between Moss and Stuhlbargen here, where they're both arguably very bad people. Stuhlbarg especially is just this particular brand of charismatic, intelligent professor that just uses that charisma and intelligence as a facade to hide some real nastiness. And yet, at the end, it's not so much he's being nasty to her or she's, you know, fighting back against him. It's more that they feed off of each other. And in the end, they kind of need each other in order to do what they do. And I think it's interesting that Decker takes that perspective on their relationship rather than seeing easy audience surrogates and heroes and villains in this story.
Yeah, and this film raises a question that has been talked about for a very long time. So it's not anything new. And it's something that was actually, I mentioned Danny Boyle's Steve Jobs, but it's something that was talked about then too, is can you be a genius and can you be successful? Can you have drive, intelligence, uniqueness, individuality, and not be a jerk? And I'm trying to think about this film and wrap my head around what exactly it's saying. It definitely doesn't present Jackson's life as something to be sought after. At the same time, this film does seem to suggest that the darkness around her and in her relationship propels her art, and that darkness somehow, her uniqueness, her strangeness, made her great. Now, obviously, like I mentioned, this is what I understand is based on a novel, there are some creative liberties with this depiction of Jackson's life. They're childless here in the film. I believe they had 3 or 4 children in real life. So this is an interpretation. It's really kind of digging into art and what that means and creation. So I don't know how much bearing it has on the real Jackson herself. But the idea of what does it take to be a good artist? Do you have to be a tortured soul? And the film says maybe. And I'm not sure if it – I guess I'm not sure how to take it. I'm not sure if by the end of it we're like, well, it's just what happens sometimes to produce something good that's dark that just really digs into the depths of our humanity. I don't know. In Steve Jobs, we get a turn where he does seek redemption. And I know that turn for many people is a little too on the nose and it is quick, but it does imply that we do need other people, that there is a way out, that being a genius isn't the only thing that's going to help us find purpose and meaning in life. I'm not sure where we land in Shirley, and maybe we're not supposed to land at a specific place. Maybe we're supposed to just sit here and kind of watch art be created and then really just think it through and think through the process in our mind and come to our own conclusions.
That's something I'm still puzzling over myself. My initial reaction to this film's final act is to feel like the tension at the heart of the relationship between Shirley Jackson and the young wife Rosie, that there's this inherent tension where it's quasi-romantic, and then there's almost the sense that Jackson is less of a partner and more or a friend and more of a mentor to Rosie, kind of showing her the ropes of what it's like to be married to a man who thinks because of his academic accomplishments that he's really hot stuff, and what to do when you're the woman who's almost invisible in that equation. Like what when you're the one who has to do the unglamorous work of staying at home and cooking the meals and taking care of the child, where do you go with that? And there's this implication that, well, you go mad. There's a line where Jackson says, lost little girls, what's the fate of all lost little girls? They go mad. And there's a sense that that happens with Rosie, but I do think that Decker maybe doesn't quite bring that part of the film home as strongly as the parts with that relate to Jackson and her writing itself. But then again, I also kind of appreciate how there is this elusive quality to that aspect of the film that I'm still trying to figure out. And it's interesting to think about. And I almost kind of want to go back and watch the film again just to see if I can pull the ends of these threads a little bit more and see what I discover. Maybe I won't discover anything, but pulling on those threads is kind of enjoyable.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good way to wrap up this review, though I don't know if I'm all too excited about trying to watch this movie again. Like I said, just wasn't a fan of the experience. Listeners, maybe you agree, maybe you don't agree. Shirley is currently streaming. It's available to rent. You can also check it out on Hulu. That's where I watched the movie. Make sure to tell us what you think about the film. You can tweet us at CBeliefPod, at CBeliefPod. You can also email us, seeingandbelieving@gmail.com. We have reached the end of our episode. It's here that we recommend something from the world of television and or film to our listeners, you out there. Kevin, you're up first. What would you like to recommend this week?
Well, I was thinking about how Shirley kind of takes us into the mind of a creative person and gives us a sense for what it's like to exist in that headspace for a little while. And that made me think about a film that really does that, only it's not a case of a director taking us into the mind of another creative person. It's the case of a director taking us into his own mind and letting us live there for a little while. I'm thinking, of course, of Akira Kurosawa's 1990 film Dreams. And this is a film that consists of a series of vignettes. All of them are based on actual dreams that Kurosawa himself had at some point, and he just sort of presents them to us without comment, and then moves on to the next one. And there are some maybe parallels that you can see in terms of the imagery and maybe some of the themes, but overall, Kurosawa's goal isn't to draw a common theme out of all of these dreams or to tie them together in any overt way. His goal is more just to present this beautiful dreamlike imagery to us and allow us to meditate on what it says about the human subconscious, what it says maybe about Kurosawa's own creative drives and concerns, but more so, you know, what meaning do we find in the weird subconscious randomness of another person's dreams? What beauties can we find there? What terrors? And what lessons? All of those things are kind of swirling around in this film. It's absolutely beautiful to look at. It was one of the last films he ever made, and it's just incredibly worth your time, especially if, like me, you are a huge Kurosawa aficionado. So yeah, definitely check out 1990s Dreams, directed by Kurosawa.
Yeah, I love Kurosawa. There's still so many of his films that I have not seen. I have not seen Dreams. I know it's one of those movies that if people, whether they like it or they just don't care for it, everybody seems to find it fascinating and worth talking about. And so that's something I definitely need to watch here soon.
Interesting.
I mean, so many good ones.
And it's interesting, a bit of trivia. It's one of Martin Scorsese's few film roles. He actually shows up in this film playing Vincent Van Gogh. So, you know, Scorsese was a huge Kurosawa fanboy himself and was really excited to actually be in a Kurosawa movie for this. So, you know, maybe a little bit of extra incentive to check it out.
That's great. You know, I was watching The Gallery, and it's a behind-the-scenes look at The Mandalorian, the Disney Plus television show. And Bryce Dallas Howard, she directed one of the episodes, and she talks about just hanging out with her dad, of course, Ron Howard, and how she went to Japan, and she went to dinner with him when she was a young girl, and he had dinner with George Lucas and Kurosawa, and she got to just kind of hang out and pal around, and then she eventually fell asleep during dinner. And it's funny that you say that, because I've seen pictures. I believe there are pictures out there with Scorsese and Kurosawa and some of the greats, and it's just, yeah, it's pretty crazy that all those people kind of got together back way back when. We lost a treasure with Kurosawa.
Yeah, we definitely did. Now I am extremely jealous of Bryce Dallas Howard, so thanks for that.
And she got to be in the Jurassic World, so there you go.
Well, maybe I'm not so jealous of her anymore.
Well, I am going to recommend a film that's actually, I feel like it's been recommended pretty regularly in the last couple of weeks, and that is Destin Daniel Cretton's Just Mercy. So this is a film about a very famous civil rights defense attorney as a young man, Brian Stevenson, and he works to free a wrongly condemned death row prisoner. Now, Michael B. Jordan plays Stevenson, and Jamie Foxx plays the prisoner. This is one of those movies that it's not perfect, and I think sometimes the plot is a little too convoluted, but it works like gangbusters in the emotion department. It features scenes that really place us into the positions of some of these characters and force us to just kind of sit there and watch. There's one death row scene that is just it's extremely well done. So I would encourage our listeners to definitely check this out. Like I said, it's been recommended by so many people in this last week. I watched it a couple months ago, I believe it was. Really liked it. It's available to stream for free in a number of different places. I think Amazon Prime is one of those places, but you can find it kind of all over the place. If you have not seen the 2019 film Just Mercy, check it out. I feel bad because it was released when a lot of films were being released at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. I just don't think it got the recognition that it deserved. I think it's a well-made movie, and hopefully more people will check it out here in the near future.
Oh yeah, that's a film that I haven't had a chance to catch up with yet myself. And it's true what you say, that just kind of it came out at a time when just so many other great movies were coming out, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. But from what I hear, it's a real shame that that happened, because it seems like a strong film, so I'll definitely have to make time for it soon.
Yeah, especially because it's kind of everywhere now, and it's awesome that they have that out there. People can watch that for free, so our listeners can check it out. That's the end of our episode. Kevin, I don't want to give too much away, but we have a new Spike Lee film to review next week. Da Five Bloods is going to be premiering on Netflix June 12th, which is when this episode drops, so I am just really pumped. This is a big movie, and it's great that we can, you know, check it out. We'd love to see it in theaters if possible, but it's just not, you know, it's not going to happen. But we can check it out on Netflix, and I'm pumped to talk about it.
For sure. I'm looking forward to that one with a lot of anticipation myself.
Yeah. So listeners, make sure to check back in next week. Thank you for listening to this episode. It's brought to you by our Patreon supporters and ChristInPopCulture.com. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ in Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes, and check out our other shows at ChristInPopCulture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.